CataractCoach.com podcast series, episode number 107 with Dr. Helen Wu, teaching refractive surgery to thousands of ophthalmologists, including me and you. Welcome back to our Cataract Coach podcast. And today I have a very special guest, someone who's taught me so much about refractive surgery over the last 20 years, and that is Helen Wu from Boston. Helen, welcome to our podcast.
Thanks for having me, Uday, and it's a real honor to be here, and thanks for all the hard work that you do. It's just so much fun to be here with you.
Yeah, it's fun. We all learn together. In fact, we were recently on a panel together at OSHA's Telient meeting, which was fantastic.
It was great. Thank you for inviting me. Thanks for not telling me any of those 9 crazy cases that you decided to show.
That is the criteria. So the people who are on my panel, every time I do Best of Cataract Coach, I do not tell the panelists any of the cases ahead of time. You don't get to see the videos until we're live.
Fair. Yeah,
obviously, that's more fun that way.
It is more fun that way. And it mimics real life, right? That's right. How it is in the OR when you walk in every day.
Right. I'll show a complication. And then people say, well, can you rewind that? No, it's like in the operating. You just saw it happen. It is what it is.
That's right. That's right.
Now, anyway, you've been a fantastic teacher over the years, especially with refractive surgery. And I've learned so much from you. So tell me about your path in ophthalmology. How'd you get started in ophthalmology? Why refractive and cataract surgery? And then how'd you become so passionate about teaching?
Well, ophthalmology started back in medical school at Ohio State. And literally, I just was interested in ophthalmology a little bit. Just wanted to learn something about the eye. Did a month in the summertime. Thought maybe I would get some time to go out, maybe take a swim in the pool. That never happened. I was there till 9 o'clock every night. I was absolutely enchanted with it. But I actually always had wanted to be an internal medicine doctor. And so I went through the rest of my medical school thinking that, and then believe it or not, I had one of those epiphanies in the middle of my OBGYN rotation where I walked into the operating room. There was no resident. It was an outside surgeon. And maybe I shouldn't say this since he probably shouldn't have done that. But he said, you know, where's the resident? And I said, yeah, you've got the medical student. That's all you've got. And he said, well, can you do this? And I said, no offense, but I've done that. I've seen that fan and steel incision about 200 times. I could do it in my sleep. He handed me the knife and assisted me. And I actually did a lysis of pelvic adhesions as a medical student together with him. And that's the moment I knew I was going into ophthalmology. It's kind of a weird story, but that's when I knew that I was meant to be a surgeon. And that was really, and then all my internal medicine attendings said, oh, if I had to do it over again, I would go into ophthalmology. So I decided a little late in my career in medical school that I was going to go into ophthalmology. But, you know, one of the moments that I remember as a medical student is sitting there in the back of the room and watching the cataract surgeon take off the patch of a woman who had not seen anything for years, and she had been blind, and her daughter was standing there. And when she took off, when the patch was taken off and she saw her daughter, she started to cry. And I started to cry. And I think everybody in the room was crying. And honestly, that joy that I got from that moment is still the joy that I get today. And that's one of the things that I love about refractive surgery, because every single patient is a celebration. Every time you take that patch off or you see them the next day and they can see, it's tears of joy for everyone. And that's a miracle to me to this day. And with every single patient.
In fact, I agree with you. I like the post-op day one patients as much as I like doing the surgery.
Yes, yes. It's a celebration every time. And it makes me feel wonderful and very blessed that I was given that gift that I could offer that to people. So cornea came about because I spent a summer in Boston when I was a medical student working with Dr. Jeff Gilbard. And I was his first research fellow. He's the inventor of TheraTears, if you don't recall who he was, and a wonderful human being. And so I spent that summer with him scraping rabbit corneas and photographing them in the middle of the night, in fact, because they healed too quickly. So I was doing one dry eye cornea and one non-dry eye cornea. And I had to come in the middle of the night. I actually got stopped by the police when I was doing that because I ran a red light. I was very tired and I was scared of the rabbits. And so there are a lot of stories about that. But that actually sort of influenced my decision to go into cornea. And then unbeknownst to me, that sort of resulted in a series of events that led me back to Boston. Dr. Stephen Foster, one of my mentors, was sitting at lunch with Dr. Gilbard and one of my fellow residents from the University of Michigan, Tony Adamus. And they were all eating lunch together, and Dr. Foster's fellow didn't make it because of Tiananmen Square, the episode in China. And so he had said, I need another fellow. And Tony mentioned my name, and Jeff knew me and put in a good word for me. And Stephen Foster called me the next day, and I came to Boston to Mass Eye and Ear for a uveitis fellowship, which really satisfied my internal medicine sorts of leanings. Right. And then I did a cornea fellowship right after that with Dr. Claus Dolman and Debbie Langston and Ken Kenyon and Roger Steinert, Mike Wagner, Tony Adamus, and I was an Art Borkoff. And I really was exceptionally, exceptionally lucky to have a series of mentors like that who really showed me all different types of refractive surgery as well as cornea surgery. Refractive surgery, this was 1990, so it was just beginning. I watched Roger probably do one of his first PRKs. That's how I got interested in it. But my first refractive surgery, I think, was Dr. Dolman doing a radial keratotomy. And he did it the American style, and it was kind of bloody, to be honest with you. There was, you know, you go from the center out to the limbus, as you know. And he said, you know, this is so easy, but all the patients are 20/20 the next day and so happy. So, you know, I do it. And that's what actually launched my career in refractive surgery, or at least my interest in it. Sure. I had always planned to go back to the Midwest. I'm from Ohio, and I had always thought that I would go back to the Midwest to be in private practice, but I had my first job offer at Tufts, and that was with Dr. Carmen Pugliafito, Dr. Michael Raisman. And basically, Carmen said to me, you know, we've got Raisman here. He does cornea. He does uveitis. You're welcome to continue to do those things, but I need a director of refractive surgery. So he sent me to different practices, and I did a series of mini fellowships with Dick Lindstrom, Dan Dury, Mickey Gordon in La Jolla, at Steve Slade. I took the Kaysbeer course with Charles Kaysbeer and started with radial keratotomy. And then I started giving my own courses, you know, and Carmen handed me an ALK machine and said, learn how to use this. Mm-hmm. So I learned how to do ALK, which was the precursor to LASIK. And basically, that's how I became the director of refractive surgery for the last 32 years at Tufts. And but I haven't stopped doing the other things that I was trained to do. So including cataract, cornea surgery, and even inflammatory diseases, uveitis and inflammatory diseases. And that's kind of how my practice evolved, because I was in this somewhat unique situation of having trained with very, very sick eyes, but doing refractive surgery. I did with Roger Steiner together. We were co-investigators. He was the PI, I was a co-investigator. And we did the Summit laser trials. So we did the PRKs and LASIK with Summit, those clinical trials, those FDA trials in the early mid 90s. And so it was a little bit, you know, I don't want to say Wild West, but we were learning every single day. You know,
it's all the new stuff. It was all very, very new. I mean, for our young audience members, if you're ophthalmologist on the age of 50, you may not know some of this stuff. So the radial keratotomy, right, was using a blade, usually a diamond, to help make radial incisions in the purple cornea to flatten the central cornea, so therefore treating myopia. And then the American method was starting in the center and going out, the periphery, and the Russian method was in the periphery going in. And then for these lasers, you're asking, what is Summit? Well, the very first excimer lasers we had, were one of them was the Summit Apex laser.
They got the first approval in the United States, actually, before Vizx. Yes. There aren't any Summits around anymore, but there are Vizx. So Vizx was shortly thereafter. And we had a Vizx laser later on, too, but we started with the Summit and the autonomous lasers and then with the microkeratomes. So with the bladed microkeratomes. And again, I went and spent time with Steve Slade, and he was amazing and taught me how to use the microkeratome for LASIK. I had learned it for ALK as well. And, you know, those were really white knuckle days, you know, the
For sure.
It was, you didn't always know what was going to happen after the microkeratome went across the eye. So I became very experienced with the mechanical microkeratome, and I could do incisional surgery. I didn't do that for very long, a few years, but and as soon as we could do PRK and LASIK, that's what we did. And then my practice sort of morphed into doing refractive surgery on patients who were a little bit different, you know, not your standard -3 600 micron cornea. Right. You know, I would get referred the 498 micron corneas that are -7 and, you know, with rheumatoid arthritis on top of it, or maybe lupus or something like that.
Right.
And so, you know, and then I would be referred also patients who had had refractive surgery, perhaps elsewhere, and needed maybe an enhancement or something to help fix some problems that they may have had. In those early days, that wasn't so uncommon with the smaller optical zone, smaller optical zones that we had, the broad beam lasers. We had, you know, a variety of interesting side effects or complications, if you will. So things have really changed since those early days in the 1990s.
Yeah. A long way. Again, for our younger audience members here, who are so, obviously they're all ophthalmologists, but very interested, the older lasers had a single broad beam, which could be as much as, you know, 5, 6, 7 millimeters in diameter. And it was a very low repetition rate. So maybe 20 Hertz, like that, And then obviously our newer lasers are these, usually have flying spots. So very small beams that are very fast. And you'll have like, you know, 4 beams simultaneously. So you have a much smoother ablation here.
Right.
Yeah. These are neat things. I mean, people don't even realize, like the first time I did LASIK as well was with the Summit, you know, Apex Pro laser, where to treat astigmatism, they had an ablatable mask. Remember that?
Right. That was a while ago too. Yes. So, and then, you know, some of the things that happened, the mechanical things that could happen on those lasers. If, for example, I had a patient where only one side of the diaphragm opened up. So, you know, I caught that after a few pulses, but I had to fix that.
Right.
So, you know, and fortunately, I had taken an electron microscopy class at University of Michigan when I was an undergrad, and I knew how to burn and dodge, you know, the photography technique of burning and dodging. And I was able to fix that. And she ended up 20/20 uncorrected, I'm happy to say, in both eyes. But, you know, you had to be a little bit more creative back in those days. There was no topo guided, no wavefront guided, no nothing. Right. So, yeah, so that was... you know, we had to think on our feet a little bit back then, but I'm very grateful to all of those patients who allowed me to care for them. And I, you know, I learned together with all of my colleagues, and that's how I became sort of a referral center for, again, refractive surgeons or refractive surgeries that perhaps weren't so straightforward, or for people who'd already had them that had issues.
Right. But yeah, for sure, the very tough cases. I mean, back in the day, so I first did LASIK as a resident. I was very lucky. I was the very first resident at UCLA to do LASIK back in maybe 1998 or 99. And yeah, you're right. It was the microkeratome to create the flap. The initial ones weren't even motorized. You had to push this carpenter's plane basically across the cornea, putting this big suction ring on, hopeful that it would just create a nice flap. And then even with the Hansatome, or the more automated ones, you just stepped on that pedal and you lose all view. You have no idea what's going to happen until it comes back. And then as soon as you take the suction ring off and you see a nice flap, you're like, sigh of relief.
Yes. You're giving me PTSD, by the way, just letting you know.
it really took its toll. Every time I did a case, every time I was just so, when my keratome started to pass across the cornea and you have no idea what's happening, you're just like, please, please, please let it work.
Yes. And you had to really choose your patients carefully. And I would say give them maybe more sedative than what we give them today. And in the Northeast, a lot of people do need sedatives, I would say. So Valium was just part of the thing. One of my early RKs actually had 20 milligrams of Valium.
20, that's a whopper.
Yeah. He actually passed out afterwards, you know, and had his wallet stolen straight out of his hands. So it was, we learned not to give quite that much with the laser vision correction, but some of them with that microkeratome really needed a lot of verbal sedation in addition to the pharmacologic sedation they received.
And then, and God forbid, one of the lashes got stuck in the gears of the microkeratome. You get all the lashes out of the way. This is why I'm such a stickler for draping. People see with the cataract coach videos, and I sometimes, if a lash is sticking, I was like, no, you've got to redrape.
Yep. That's absolutely right. That's right. And it was hard with those deep set eyes and You had to learn how to maneuver the head position and all sorts of things. People don't realize how lucky they have it with these lower suction microkeratosis, you know, sort of suction rings these days. Yeah. Yeah. So, but you know, I'm happy to say I don't have nearly as much stress now when I do my surgeries as I did back then. And, you know, I think teaching, you know, you mentioned doing those as a resident. I think teaching it is, you know, requires even more gut strength. than gut lining, I should say, than doing it. You know, that's, you can't really control a microkeratome at all from the side. Not, of course, I would reach in and adjust things. But like you said, once it gets going, you know, if they start to bear down and squeeze, it's a problem no matter who's running that pedal. So,
I had a special trick I'd do sometimes. I'd put my index and middle finger on the speculum, push it into the orbit to prop toast the globe forwards more.
Yes, yes. It's a great trick. It's a great, great trick. Assuming you have a well enough sedated patient, I guess.
Right. You got to do that a little bit. And then also, you want, back then we used such high vacuum pressures. So you basically, the vision of the patient grayed out or blacked out.
Totally blacked
out. So I always ask the patient, is your vision grayed out for you? And then before passing the microkeratome, after I got the suction ring on and I got the pressure, I thought it was good, I used my right index finger tonometer and touch the cornea, make sure it's nice and firm, and then do it.
Yes, it's good. It's good. Yeah, I have, you know, it's funny, the patients would react all different ways too. We always had smelling salts there just in case. I've had to use those a few times. I've had people, you know, nearly break the hand of the hand holder. Right. I've had people flip their shoes across the operating room and scream at the top of their lungs and, you know, basically alarm anybody who was out in the hallway. So yeah, it was fun times back then, but
it kind of begs the question though, how do you teach it? So one of the questions we get a lot is, even today in 2025, we have residents who finish USA ophthalmology residency and graduate with zero hands-on LASIK or corneal refractive surgery experience. How do you get started?
Right. Well, you know, that's the thing. The AUPO standards are they have to observe or participate in six cases. And that can be an LRI, that can be a PRK, that can be a LASIK. So some programs have a lot more than that. Some barely make the minimum requirement. And watching an LRI, I would argue, isn't quite the same as doing a LASIK. But frankly, even doing 100 LASIK as a resident, which would be so nice if we could offer that, and we don't, we didn't when the year 32 years I'm at Tufts, I was at Tufts, but it's the knowledge behind the what you're doing that's more important than the actual surgical procedure. And of course, it's just like cataract surgery, you have to do it to be good at it. But it's frankly a lot easier to do than cataract surgery, I would argue. And it's really choosing the right patients and learning how to do the postoperative care that's most important. So for 32 years, we've had cornea and refractive fellows. But those, again, even in a place like Tufts that doesn't have high volume, and many academic centers don't have high volume surgery, it's still hard to give a fellow even an adequate number of cases to even feel good about it. And of course, you don't know what you don't know, right? So, you know, and a lot of residents didn't really understand over the years. And again, that's four residents a year. I've trained over 120 residents. And a lot of them didn't realize as they were going through their residency that refractive surgery is really important. And when you get out in the real world, when you go to that cocktail party or you're with your aunt and uncle, the question comes up about LASIK more than anything else, right? That's all they want to know about is LASIK. Right. It doesn't matter if you're a retina surgeon or whatever. Everyone wants to know about LASIK. So, you know, you go and what I saw happening was that, you know, they would go they would get affiliated with a laser center perhaps, and then spend their first 10 eyes with an Alcon rep or one of the reps from one of the companies, and then they would be signed off on, and then they were good to go. And so, but that's just the very, very beginning. If you've done 10 or even 100 LASIK, you really need to know what the science behind refractive surgery. Right. And pick the right patients so that you don't end up with ectasia or severe dry eye, or you recognize that corneal neuropathic pain when it happens. Because just excusing that and saying it's dry eye, it'll go away, that's not going to help the problem in a corneal neuropathic pain patient. So, you know, what I've done besides my career at Tufts, I also on the weekends, I am the academic director for the RSA Fellowship Network. And that came about.
Refractive Surgery Alliance.
Refractive Surgery Alliance Fellowship Network. That's right. So basically, you know, I realized that even when I was seeing my young colleagues that had had perhaps a fellowship somewhere where they may have done 100 LASIK, they still didn't know the background behind all of it. They still weren't able to know what procedure to offer what candidate. So that's sort of what gave birth to the idea of the RSA Fellowship Network. Certainly in private practice, you get lots more cases. You know, that's a fact. I think you go out there and you could easily end up doing several hundred, if not more, LASIK in a year. But you don't have the academics necessarily behind you. So, and then there's a lot of places where even if you did have an academic, you know, desire to have the academics behind you, there's no place to do that. So necessity is the mother of invention, right? And the pandemic was a terrible thing, but it gave us the gift of Zoom. And right. So we were able to create a program. And I credit Guy Kazarian also with this. We sat and talked about it over many years' time. What could we do to create a generation of refractive surgeons that was as good as the previous generation in a much smaller amount of time? And again, part of that also was because I was seeing, perhaps through work with malpractice attorneys and so forth, that mistakes were being done, were being committed that could have been avoided by just knowing the underlying or the background of refractive surgery by going to those meetings from 15 or 20 years ago where Howard Gimbel talked about, you know, Hayes or Francesco Coronas talked about Hayes, you know, if you do surface ablation over LASIK or, you know, some of those other types of things, learning about risk factors for ectasia. So we came up with a program and I created a 2-year basically curriculum, a standardized curriculum where the private practice fellows who would learn their clinical and surgical refractive surgery from their mentors would then on Saturdays meet, and we call them conclaves. No white smoke, you know, they basically would have sort of like grand rounds, case presentations, and then a lecture by a visiting professor. And then on certain weekends, they would also have journal club and they have research requirements and so forth. So at the end of 2 years, these fellows would have had high numbers because they're in private practice. A lot of these fellows actually were junior associates that the senior associate wanted to have training for. And it's been amazing. We're on our 5th year now. And I would say that these fellows, you know, have amazing knowledge. They had a fellowship that they are having a fellowship that I never had. I wish I could have had that type of fellowship. So I'm just this year adding on glaucoma and retina into that. And every year I try to change it up a little bit in terms of the curriculum. But I really think that's helpful. And I wish every subspecialty would do that. Frankly, it's a lot. It's a lot to ask somebody to sit for 3 hours. Two right. Saturdays a month, and then another hour-long journal club. But these are fellows that are all over the world. We have, you know, one fellow in Hawaii this year and one fellow in India and everywhere in between. We've got several European ones, several African ones, several in South America, and several in the United States. And so that's been a real joy for me to develop that on the side. And I really enjoy teaching like that as well. I love having a resident or a fellow sitting right next to me. And, you know, I think that's that's irreplaceable. You have to have a mentor that's sitting beside you. But to have the ability to get didactics in an organized way, I think is a real gift too. And so I was very lucky. Like I said, I had two amazing fellowships at Mass Eye and Ear. Mm-hmm. But the standardization of the curriculum is something that hasn't happened yet for refractive surgery. So I'm happy to say we've made some headway with that. And we've had so far a really great run in our fellowship.
Yeah, the curriculum is really amazing. It is true. Now, how can our listeners learn more about this? If they want, let's say you're a resident, you want to apply to one of these fellowships, or maybe you're a young ophthalmologist just starting practice, how can they learn more?
Well, I would go to, if they're interested in the fellowship, rsafellows.com. Just Google us and take a look. And, you know, it's nice to have a preceptor. So it's nice to actually look for somebody who's doing that. There are refractive fellowships out there that, for example, Greg Parkhurst has one. We currently have Sandy Feldman in California, who's a preceptor. There are people who do preceptorships every year, but many of them are just people who are taking on a junior associate, like I said. So, you know, if that's something that interests you, I would look on rsafellows.com. Identify a preceptor. And again, that's usually somebody whose practice you're joining, ideally a refractive surgeon, and then submit an application. If you're not going to do a fellowship, I think it's a little harder because you're reinventing the wheel a bit. And if you're just doing refractive fellowship, it's again great to have a more experienced mentor, and ideally several mentors, because again, if you're just learning from one person, it doesn't give you quite the breadth of experience or approaches, I should say, perhaps, that one might get with sort of a group. And so that's I would say don't just learn it from the reps, and believe me, there is such a place for them, and they are so supportive. Our Alcon reps have every time I do a topo guided, I'm on the phone with them, and they're helping me plan it and make sure that I'm putting in the right things. And so they're invaluable. But with your first cases, and even as you go along, it's a lot better to have a longer training period than just a weekend or a few weeks, actually.
Right. It's amazing that these types of fellowships exist now, because, you know, a decade ago, certainly two decades ago, this was unheard of. But even 10 years ago, I don't know of any of these types of fellowships. It's very unusual.
Yes. Yes. So, you know, and I think honestly, every cataract surgery is a refractive surgery. And now we have so many more choices. The technology is so much better than it used to be. And it's a little confusing, not just for the patients, but for the surgeons too. You know, what's the best person to put an Odyssey in, or an Envy, or should I just stick with an enhanced monofocal and do a little mini monovision / blended vision, you know? And there's a lot of subtlety and a lot of art to refractive surgery. And I think that comes with watching a very experienced mentor. So, you know, and going to meetings and taking courses, watching videos. I mean, I think it's really a huge field. People don't appreciate how much nuance there is to it until they start getting into it and appreciate that.
Yeah, you're right. It's a very different thing to do just like, say, an academic cornea fellowship with a little bit of refractive thrown in versus a dedicated, this is a refractive surgery fellowship.
Yes.
Very, very different.
Yes, they're very different. They're very different. And I've trained over 60 fellows, but side by side, but they are predominantly cornea. Okay. And so, you know, we do cataract surgery and cornea surgeries together, and all of the infectious disease and inflammatory disease that all of that entails. And it's a lot of fun, but it's not the same thing as a pure refractive surgery. And you need people like that who are trained in cornea and refractive too, because again, it's not always going to go completely well. And sometimes you're going to need somebody who's, you know, can help you with more advanced procedures with your cornea colleagues. So there's certainly a place for those type of fellowships too. But if you're really going to go out there and do refractive surgery, I would try to devote yourself to it for a year or two, and preferably two. I really do think, you know, that second year adds a lot. Our second year RSA fellows are actually associates, so they're not really considered fellows anymore. They're making a regular salary and so forth, but they're still doing the didactics and keeping the surgical logs and all of that, and keeping up with the their research projects. And that gives them a broader perspective. And, you know, I look back on our first and second classes now, and they're the questions that they ask each other on their chat groups, and the cases that they talk about are just at such a higher level, such a more nuanced level than what I ever saw from any of my cornea and refractive fellows or any of the people who did standard cornea and refractive fellowships around the country. And they catch up, you know, eventually if they're really dedicated to refractive surgery, but it takes a while. So we're just trying to consolidate that practice and really help build, you know, sort of get back to the basics with refractive surgery. And that in turn should help us develop even better technology as we have more educated folks that are dedicated to the field.
Right. I mean, now it's such the spectrum, the width of refractive surgery has increased so much.
Yes.
Now you can do anything from care, you know, the various forms of care refractive surgery, but now also phakic lenses. Now you've got the whole cataract refractive lens exchange, all the spectrum, new IOLs. Maybe you're going to do a concomitant glaucoma or angle procedure, mixed procedure at the same time. You've got so much going on here. Plus now the depth is so much more. I think the advantage that young people have is they do have the ability to shorten the learning curve because of resources like your RSA Alliance, your curriculum, your interactive sessions, you know, everyone these Saturday mornings, and also watching videos online.
This is absolutely
the resources is unbelievable.
Absolutely. And cataractcoach.com. I've heard you talk about refractive surgery plenty of times in cataractcoach.com. So, and keep up the good work. And by the way, all of my fellows watched that, and the few that didn't know about it, immediately I told them about it, and they started tuning in. So you've got viewers from all over the world there, and it's an incredible service. I mean, I think in the old days, there was Video Journal of Ophthalmology. Yeah, you remember that? We had to go get the VHS tapes and stick them in and watch them, and, you know, hopefully they weren't broken or too messed up. And, you know, that's how we got our video knowledge back then. And, you know, I have to give it to Bobby Osher talking about that meeting in Orlando last week. I mean, that's how I learned my cataract surgery, was sitting there at the Hawaii and I meeting and listening to him show videos, watching his videos and hearing him honestly talk about his complications and how he handled them. And, you know, that's how I taught my residents and fellows too. And, you know, big shout out to him as well for being one of those early teachers that inspired me as well.
Yeah, I call him the godfather, El Padrino, as we say in Spanish. He's the absolute godfather of this, no question.
He is. There are so many people, and, you know, we walk on the shoulders of giants, right? Yeah. I mean, we stand on the shoulders of giants. And, you know, for me, I was very fortunate. I mentioned Dr. Dolman, but Dr. Steinert, Roger Steinert, was one of my mentors. And, you know, he and Dr. Foster, and those people taught me how to think, you know, and not to be scared. And to keep learning. Those things are incredibly important in your life. And, you know, if you're not sure what's going on, talk to people. Turn on a video now. Read. You can learn so much more now than before, but don't be scared to do things that you're not sure about. Just do the background research that you need to do to move forward in your career and learn new skills, because everybody has to learn new skills at some point or another, or you stagnate.
Oh, 100%. Now, you were comparing earlier how I agree with you that learning LASIK is a lot easier than learning cataract surgery.
Yes.
And my rough analysis, and I'd love to hear your take on this, was that, like, you need to do 500 cataracts to be pretty good. And I think for LASIK, it's like 1/10 that. You need like 50 to be pretty good.
Pretty good at the procedure, but not necessarily at picking the patients.
That's a whole different skill set. Or also managing the unusual complications that happen in a small percent of patients. You got to do a large volume to see all that.
Right. That's right. To see the squeezing and the fainting and the, you know, the weird loss of suction that happens with somebody with too much conjunctiva or something like that. Yeah, that's true. And that's where these, I think, private practice refractive fellowships really have the advantage, because you're going to see thousands of cases in a couple of years. So our fellows typically will finish with about 1,000 cases in 2 years. And that's everything. That's laser vision correction. That's cataract surgery. But those are pretty good numbers. But yeah, sure, you can do maybe 25 PRK and 50 LASIK or something like that, especially now that we're mostly using femtosecond lasers and maybe a little bit more than that for SMILE. But, you know, it's, I would argue that we really need that training for the pre and post-op care.
Oh, for sure. And as you said, also patient selection. I mean, that's one of the challenges. I think if we were really, really careful with patient selection, is as I've gotten older, I'm like even more selective with patients now.
Yep. Yes. Yes. And now that we have more technology, you know, it kind of makes you almost more selective.
Right.
I have a patient now, I haven't touched her. She, you know, because we have confocal microscopy at Tufts, and she mentioned that she had some photosensitivity. So, you know, I did a confocal microscopy of her and she's loaded with inflammatory cells in her cornea.
Wow.
Tried to put her on steroids, couldn't really, you know, do them. Or once she finally did do them, once she finally could afford them, didn't really change the inflammation much. So I haven't touched her because I don't really want to see her get worse. I don't want to see her get corneal neuropathic pain, you know? And so, and this is a big question mark. Would she get it? It's not really clear. But I know that she's not normal and I have more tools in my armamentarium now to assess whether somebody's normal or not. And of course we owe people like Renato Ambrosio with his AI, using AI for his Pentacam and so forth, Michael Bellin, you know, people like that, a big debt of gratitude for pointing out these corneas that we might've done, you know, in the, in the early 2000s, but wouldn't touch now with what we know from corneal tomography. And so now with confocal microscopy, being able to actually look at the nerves, look at the structure of the cornea, you know, I would argue that perhaps we'll get even more selective with time. We don't know yet, right? But, you know, there's that question mark. Should you do it? Should you not?
No, for sure. I think, like, if I look at 100 patients walking to the clinic door asking for, let's say, cataract surgery, what percent do we actually do surgery on? Or that procedure on? Maybe we'll switch them to something else, but I think maybe it's 80-85%. I mean, I'm blocking like a lot more patients than before. It's like, you know, your cornea looks a little funny, tissues are a little too thin. As you said, maybe do another procedure. For you, what percent of patients do you think who come in wanting LASIK do you end up saying no to or switching to something else?
Well, I mean, I do a lot of surface ablation. I'm a big, big believer in surface ablation. That's maybe because I live in the Northeast. There's hardly any UV light. I have very good results with that. But I would say, a good percentage of them, at least a third, I turned down at least for LASIK. And now I do ICLs and I think that's fabulous. And if I could have done an ICL on that young lady with all the inflammation in her cornea, I would think about that, but she's only a minus 1.5 or 2. You know, and surface ablation isn't going to necessarily be good for somebody still, even with an irregular cornea, especially somebody who's young, you don't really know. So I may bring them back a year, 6 months, a year later and look at them again. So I'm pretty conservative when it comes to that, because again, I wouldn't do something to a patient that I wouldn't do to my family member. So that's how I try to treat all of my patients, as if they were my family. And so, you know, that's golden rule. And I feel that's incredibly important.
For sure. I think that's one of the smartest things you can do. And when patients hear that from you, like, okay, when you say, hey, if you were my son or daughter, or if you were my sister or brother, I would do this. Then they're like, okay, that's from the heart.
Yeah. Yeah. I have had a Harvard Law School student argue with me about that.
That's too funny.
So I tried to send him to somebody else, but you know, truly, I said, honestly, seriously, I don't really care if you're, you know, God, I just really don't want you to have this surgery. You have, you know, a 480 micron cornea and posterior elevation and you're 24 years old. And I really just don't think you should have LASIK PRK or anything else. And so, you know, I enlisted the help of his father who fished, he reeled him in and heard a little sense, but that's the only patient I've had argue with me with that line in many, many, many years.
But, you know, he doesn't know how lucky he is that he ended up finding you.
for sure. For sure.
He could have gone somewhere else who would have lasered him the same day, and then he'd be dealing with ectasia and other grief for the rest of his life.
Yeah. Yeah. So, or maybe not. Maybe they would have gotten away with it. And maybe he went somewhere else and he got away with it. But I like to sleep at night. I don't like to think that I did something that could have caused harm to somebody knowingly. So that's how I live my life. That's how I try to practice medicine. And that's, you know, generally served me over these years.
Sure, for sure. Now, changing gears here a little bit. You and I were both kind of mid-career. What's next on the horizon for you?
Well, I have just finished my 32-year stint at Tufts. And So thank you. So I am going to join a private practice, a small private practice in the area, about 15 minutes away from my home. I'm very excited. It's called Newton Wellesley Eye Associates. And I have known those folks for decades. And fortunately, now they're moving into a bigger office. So they had room for me. And the reason that I really am making a transition is because I'm at that stage, like you said, more than mid-career, I would say. And depends on how you define the word mid. And I am looking to the future and thinking about what I would like to do going forward and how I would like to balance my work and life. And for me, working 4 days a week and then having the potential in 10 years or 15 years when I feel like it to perhaps maybe not do as much surgery, maybe just not do surgery at all, cut down to 1, 2, or 3 days a week, maybe take off 2 months in the wintertime and go to Hawaii, my favorite place. And so that gives me the opportunity to do that. Whereas at least in our department at Tufts, we're a smaller department and, you know, I did everything. I was doing K-pros and penetrating keratoplasties, you know, suturing them up in the middle of the night, rupture globes and you name it. I was doing it. And you have to kind of make a decision at a certain point in your life, you know, how you want to live the rest of your life. And so I love teaching, but I'm still doing that on weekends. And I hope I'll still continue to do that as I move forward. And so this made a lot more sense for me in terms of my career path. And, you know, so it wasn't an easy decision to make. It's always easier to stay where you are. But it's something I've been thinking about for a long time. And, you know, I think that for me, anyway, it makes the most sense. And I'll still be doing the same types of surgeries and seeing the same types of patients for the most part that I was before, but in a perhaps a more controlled way. And it will give me a little more time to take care of myself and my family and, you know, spend more time with the people that matter to me.
I think that's so important. And I agree with you. You have to change gears every once in a while. And so I did the same thing. I taught residents from 2000 to 2022 and retired at age 52. If you do some math, quick math in your head there. And so now it's like, that was, looking back, it was a hard decision to make, but it was so much the right decision. You got
to. I'm glad to hear that.
Yeah.
Really glad to hear that.
Yeah, and certainly different stages too. You value things a little differently. I value more autonomy. I want to be able to do things I couldn't do before. Like in 2024, I lectured in 21 countries. Like I can't do that, but still being working with the residents every single week, I don't have to travel now.
Right. That's
so
right.
You have to balance it out. So I think you're doing a great thing. I think you've done obviously huge service. You've taught, gosh, hundreds of medical students and residents and fellows over the course of multiple decades. And now you're still going to continue teaching, which I like. People said, did you stop teaching? No, I teach every day on Cataract Coach. I mean, the world is my audience. It's 1 million views a month. And so
there's more room to even expand. You could even probably do more past cataract surgery and all of that. There are so many avenues you could go down, but you know, it's such a service that you provide and you reach arguably far more people now than you did before.
Right. And so yeah, Cataract Coach, we do obviously cataract, glaucoma, cornea, refractive. But now as of March 1, we also have retinarounds.com, my sister channel.
Wonderful.
Retina stuff. And it's not me doing it. I have a fantastic retina surgeon who's doing those videos too. But yeah, I think there's a lot more to learn. And just to share the knowledge with our colleagues, the best.
Absolutely. You know, I love those cataract surgery simulators. Bonnie Henderson, you know, is working with those. I saw her in Rwanda, and she was working there with those. And I think this is, you know, that's one way of sort of teaching people how to handle complications because it simulates them. But this is another way. It gives people a picture in their mind. Oh, okay. You know, the posterior capsule broke. I remember these last 10 videos I watched. And it's sort of a pattern recognition type of thing, right? That you can say, okay, you know, this is the kind where I can do this, or it's subincisional and I can't do this. Or now, you know, it's going into Berger space and I must do posterior assisted levitation, whatever it is. But you've seen it already, or you've experienced it already. So, you know, I think it's wonderful. And I think as we get older too, you know, those more global concerns or aspirations are really, really important. I mean, it's important for me to know that I'm helping my fellows that are in Africa. I'm giving them something they couldn't necessarily get anywhere else. And therefore, secondarily, I'm helping a lot of patients that I don't lay hands on personally, but I know they're getting safer care and better care because of indirectly things that I did. And so, you know, I'm happy to do them. And actually, I hope that I'll be able to travel more now. You know, that's sort of a goal of mine, is to do a little more global ophthalmology now that, you know, that I'll have more time.
Well, you're such a natural teacher. I think you'd be fantastic. That'd be great. I mean, get your name out there. People would open, you know, welcome with open arms. You have so much to offer. Like in our meeting this last weekend, you were so amazing on the podium. And even though I blindsided you, in case you've never seen before. It was fun. I think you're just a great teacher. And in fact, I got to admit, even many years ago when I was, you know, barely starting out in practice, maybe the early 2000s, and I wanted to like, okay, let me learn more. I'd come to a lot of your courses you would give about learning refractive surgery. I'm like, let me learn from her. She's good. I like her.
Thank you. I didn't even realize that, but thank you. I appreciate it. So, and that gives me joy to hear that too. You know, and I'm glad that in some small way I've made a difference, you know, in this world. That's all we can hope for, right?
Right. Because I didn't do a fellowship. I finished my residency. I'm like, okay, I'm ready to work with my four eyes under my belt. Not four patients, four eyes, two patients.
Well, you're lucky you had that many, honestly. Well, that's how I learned too. That was the point. You know, there were no refractive for surgery fellowships. I went and learned from Dick Lindstrom and Steve Slade and Dan Dury. And again, those are giants of ophthalmology. I feel very, very fortunate to have worked with them and learned from them. So, you know, that's how any of us get going, right? And there'll be something else someday that, you know, will another fellowship that will open up because of some other new thing, you know, a pain, you know, an eye pain fellowship or something like that. You know, there's always new things that are happening. So the goal is to be as open-minded and willing and curious as you possibly can going forward.
Right. And it's okay to have a little bit of fear. Like when I first learned how to do DMEC a few years ago, I learned by watching videos. And the very first case I'm doing there at the county hospital with the resident, I'm like, okay, it's my first one too. Let's find out. I said, I've watched the videos 100 times. Let's try. The videos make it look much easier.
Oh, yeah.
That actually was. But then after about 10 of those, like, you know what? I'm like, I'm okay now. I can take the training wheels off. Yes. I think I can do okay with this.
Yes. It's like a drummer, you know, with DMAC. You know, you're just sitting there pounding on the cornea. When is this ever going to unroll? So, but right. Yeah, then you learn the tricks. Like anything else, then you learn the tricks. So, yeah. So it has given me great pleasure, though. Teaching has been one of the joys that I have. And even on a day-to-day basis, I mean, when we're seeing our patients, we're always teaching too, right? And that's how I try to really you know, work with my patients is to educate each and every single one what's going on with them, you know, and I appreciate that if a primary care doctor does that with me and I appreciate, you know, that when I'm trying to teach my patients, you know, it can be a challenge. They don't always understand. They don't always speak English. They don't always get it. And they may have been told something totally different by another doctor. So it's, you know, education is something that we literally do as physicians every single day, you know, and so that gives you practice, I think, in doing that. And you have to teach a whole lot of different people in a whole lot of different ways to explain things so that they understand them.
Right. That's one of the challenges, of course, making sure your patient understands. Now, how do you approach a patient who you've explained everything to the patient, and the patient just has such unrealistic expectations that you're almost afraid to do their surgery. Now, what do you do? How do you tell them no?
Well, you know, I've seen all sorts of things. You have really dry eyes and you need to go to that dry eye specialist down the street. I don't do that though. Although I will, if I think that they actually have something, you know, that is a confounding factor. I may ask them to get another opinion about it. If I don't feel that they completely understand, I may ask them to go see somebody perhaps who has done, you know, more of them. Or, you know, let's say they've done thousands of K-pros as opposed to my number of K-pros, something like that. I may do that. I have operated on those patients. You know, sometimes I've had them sign things. But the bottom line is, you know, everybody's, you can't always tell when somebody has unrealistic expectations. Right. They nod and say, yes, 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 yes. And then you find out later on, after you've done the surgery on them, that perhaps they didn't convey the depth of their unrealistic expectations to you. So I've operated on plenty of them. I like to have my staff alert me ahead of time if they think a patient has unrealistic expectations. So, you know, there are little signs, or, you know, usually the staff will just pull me over and say, you know, they're tough. This one is tough, especially the staff who've worked with me for a long time. Mm-hmm. And, you know, they know how I operate, and they understand, you know, sort of patience, and it's really nice when you have somebody you've worked with for a very long time who can just roll with you almost without thinking about it and kind of be on the same train track that you are. And so it really helps to have a good staff around you to alert you to those sorts of patients. I think videos help. I think, you know, you can spend unlimited amounts of time with people doing an informed consent. But the fact of the matter is that you're not necessarily going to reach everybody. And then, you know, if you think it's a dangerous thing, sometimes just saying no is the best way, particularly in an elective procedure. And what I'm talking about when I've gone with it is usually when it wasn't an elective procedure. It was something that had to be done. And I did the best I could to explain it to them, write it down, draw pictures, mm-hmm. talk to family members that I thought might understand better, bring them back another time, send them off to somebody else. I've done all of those things. But if it's an elective procedure, then I think it's sometimes no is the best thing you can do for them.
Yeah, I think you're right. I had a patient reluctantly that I said no to recently. Into younger patient, into Tumescent white cataract for more than 10 years, afraid to have surgery, unilateral. So much so when the patient comes in, the patient has 20 diopters of sensory exotropia already. And the patient's fixated on, like, what techniques are you going to use? Will you be doing this intraoperative aberrometry? I said, you know, we're not there. I said, we're just trying to clear your visual axis. I have no idea what's going on in the posterior segment of your eye even. The B scan's okay, but you did the ultrasound. I was like, well, the B scan gives me an image like an ultrasound of a baby before birth. I can tell it's a baby, but I can't really tell how the baby looks. You got to wait till tomorrow. So it's the same. I can't measure your eye even. And so the patient just drove me nuts back and forth with dozens of emails. I just finally said, I just don't think I'm the surgeon for you. I don't think I have the technology or the skills to make you happy.
And I think you did the right thing. You did the right thing. Dozens of emails is always a warning sign.
Right? And I tried my best. Just like, just reply back very patiently. I just, okay. But after like so many emails, I just cannot. You just need surgery immediately. You need to fix your white cataract. You waited 10 years.
Wow. Those, you know, it's you learn those things too, I think, with time. And I think when I was first starting my career, I was far more likely to operate on patients mm-hmm. like that. Right. You know, because you want to please people, I think, when you want to do something good. And all you've learned throughout your residency and fellowship is basically how to do surgery. So that's how you respond is, you know, let's see, let me think what surgery would be the best for you. But sometimes you learn those sort of art of medicine things a little bit slowly, and it takes some years and maybe being burned a couple of times or so before you realize there's another way to do that. So, but being eager to please, I think, is a very common thing that I see in young doctors. And, you know, it's hard to say no sometimes.
Right. So the only rotation in med school that I didn't achieve honors in was psychiatry. And so I think the problem I have is I keep trying to pick psychiatric disease through eye surgery. Somehow pseudophakia does not fix psych disease. It just doesn't.
No, no, it does not. And actually, I would argue, and this is actually maybe a quote from my friend Bill Bond, you know, if you want to see psychiatric disease, just operate on someone. And then you'll be sure to bring it out. So
right.
I don't want to take credit for that one, but that's an honest to God truth. I think one of those universal truths.
Wow. Yeah. But it's funny. We learn so much as we go on. I just love how you're passing on to the next generation. That to me is that's the most admirable of all. And I really wish you the best in your practice. I think you're doing the right thing. I think you'll look back in a year or two and say it was the best thing ever. I really do.
Thank you. Well, I'm looking forward to it. I have no reservations whatsoever. I have no regrets about the 32 years I spent at Tufts. And, you know, I'm really looking forward to the next phase. And, you know, and there's plenty more things to do. I mean, in the end, my mentor, Claus Dolman, I think was practically working until the day he passed at 101 or whatever he was at that point. And you know, I remember asking him when he was about late 70s, when I finished my fellowship, and asked him when he was planning on retiring. And he said, well, when they carry me out of here horizontally. And, you know, maybe he wasn't doing the same things at 95 that he was doing when he was 75.
Right.
But he was interested in research and he was interested in a lot of different things. And so he kept himself busy up until the very end. And even if it's not in ophthalmology, I think that's another important thing is, you know, you can always morph. And there's always new things to do and new ways to help and new ways to serve. And, you know, that's what we're really here for, you know, is to do good. And so, you know, and he really is one of the very most important role models in my life. And I hope they didn't carry him out horizontally, but I wouldn't have been surprised if they did. And that would have made him happy, to be honest. And, you know, bless his soul. He was an amazing human being and gave so much. We have a huge debt of gratitude. All of us. He was the grandfather. He was the godfather of cornea, like Bobby Osher is for cataract surgery.
For sure. No, I think that's just great. Actually, lesson from him that keep yourself engaged. Maybe you're not doing surgery anymore when you're that age, but he still has passion about these projects he's involved in.
Yes.
I think you keep up a passion, keep yourself busy. Yeah, I don't want to just sit at home all day. I want to keep achieving things and accomplishing things. I gotta keep moving.
Yes. Yes. We all need to have a video editor like you too. Or maybe you do your own video editing. I don't know.
You know, I edit them myself because the problem is even if I hired a Hollywood video editor, how do I explain to that person what is a capsule rexus?
Well, that's true.
How do I tell them what's important in this surgery? Like, can you edit this hour down to 5 minutes? They have no idea what's important. So
yes.
That becomes tough. So I have to do it. Unfortunately, I got to do it myself.
It's hard to find Hollywood stars that are ophthalmologists at the same time. Very, very hard. Maybe, I don't know, Ming Wang or somebody like that, you know, but it's pretty hard to find.
Yeah. Fun stuff. Well, again, I want to thank you for doing our podcast. I can't believe we've been talking for an hour already. Time flies when you're having fun.
Thank you so much.
Oh, thank you. I want to remind our listeners and viewers, remember, we got a new Cataract Coach podcast every Sunday on Amazon, Apple, Google, Spotify, everywhere you get your podcast, you find the Cataract Coach podcast. Plus, of course, there's a new CataractCoach.com video every single day. We're at 2,500 videos. And now we have a Retina Rounds video every single day. Check it out. Until next time, I'll check you later.